Today we look at Theresa May's looming Brexit challenge in Brussels and in Parliament. And as Prince Charles turns 70, The Guardian's Caroline Davies tells us what it's like covering the royals. We'll start after this.
The Transport Minister Joe Johnson quits over Brexit, while the DUP accuses Theresa May of
British Prime Minister Theresa May is facing this Brexit deadline that is fast approaching with seemingly no solution in hand.
But all Cabinet members are going to be judged at the bar of history by what they do over the next few weeks. Judgment Day is coming.
If Britain cannot get a Brexit deal this week, it risks running out of road before the deadline in March.
I will not compromise on what people voted for in the referendum. This will not be an agreement at any cost.
Last night, Theresa May admitted things were coming to a head.
The negotiations for our departure are now in the end game.
But the end game in Brussels is just the start of her problems in Westminster. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, is there any Brexit deal that Theresa May can get through Parliament?
Hello.
Heather.
Hi, Anoushka.
How are you doing?
Hi, I'm well, thanks.
Thank you for doing this.
Not at all.
So we need you to help us out because everything's gone crazy. Ministers are resigning. Everyone's saying there's 24 hours to save a Brexit deal. Now they're saying that's not going to happen. Please tell us, why is this week so important?
So this is meant to be a crucial week in Brexit for Theresa May.
Heather Stewart is The Guardian's political editor.
She really wants to get her cabinet behind her, then to strike a deal with Brussels, which would allow them to sign off on the idea of having a summit of EU leaders in November, later this month, to seal that deal. Then she brings it back to Parliament, gets MPs to back it, she hopes, and then passes all the legislation that we need, and out we come in March next year. Without that deal, very soon, the timetable starts to look incredibly tight.
So just explain to us what's been agreed so far and what the sticking points are.
Most of what's been agreed so far is in the withdrawal agreement, which is the terms of our exit from the EU, if you like. And what's been agreed already is the divorce bill, how much we pay to leave, which is about £39 billion or thereabouts. What will happen to EU citizens living here and British citizens living abroad, which is broadly that their rights will be protected in future. But there's one key sticking point remaining, and that's how to prevent a hard border in Ireland.
And speaking of that, it seems a bit ludicrous almost. I mean, we've gone from talking about
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit to
backstop means backstop.
Backstop means backstop. Heather, what does the backstop mean?
Yes, chatting to someone in Westminster last week, we were saying we're in danger of disappearing up our own backstops. It feels a bit as if the talks have been reduced to this kind of very arcane discussion. But it's become the absolute heart of things. And
it's very technical, isn't it? But I know that you can do it in 60 seconds. Come on, explain it to me in 60 seconds. What is the backstop?
Both sides have agreed they won't have a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. This is the sort of insurance clause. So if we don't have a trade deal set up that allows goods to flow freely backwards and forwards across that border, how do we ensure that it remains open? And we've been busy drafting and redrafting and arguing about that really now for months.
Just explain why the backstop has become so tricky.
Well, it's because Theresa May's trying to do something almost impossible, really. So she wants to take us out of a customs union with the EU. She wants us to be able to strike our own trade deals and, you know, be a sort of free trading nation. That's one thing. But if you're going to do that, you are going to need checks at the border. But she desperately doesn't want checks between Northern Ireland and the Republic. The only alternative to that is to give Northern Ireland a kind of special status, a closer relationship to the EU. But then you're going to have checks between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
For all the noise around it, and Heather, I've been covering this with you for a while, we know that there's lots of theatrics in Brussels and then they do tend to get to a deal. If that happens here, she should in theory be on track to take us out of the EU with a deal on time. But first she needs to get it through our Parliament, and that's where her troubles begin.
We are entering the final stages of these negotiations. This is
Absolutely. I mean, never mind theatrics in Brussels. Theatrics in Westminster are even more dramatic at the moment than usual. And what's happening is that Brexit's absolutely cutting across party lines at the moment. And it's really striking that as someone who sits in the House of Commons and looks down on those famous green benches and watches what's going on, that increasingly Theresa May is being challenged not just from opposite her, from where the Labour Party sit.
It is clear, Mr. Speaker, this government is not capable of securing a deal to protect the economy, jobs and living standards.
But from behind her, from her own MPs, and not just from one side, from those who are very keen
on
Brexit.
Speaker, could the Prime Minister inform the House at what point it was decided that Brexit means Remain?
But from the other side too, from those who wish Brexit wasn't happening at all.
Prime Minister, the people in this country are now really concerned and worried about no deal. Yeah. Businesses, yes. EU citizens living here, British citizens living in the EU.
So, you know, it's an issue that has cut across party lines.
Does Parliament feel different now to you, Heather?
Well, it certainly feels like we're in the end game. And there's all kinds of plotting going on in the backbenches. So there are these different factions and groups. Some of them cooperate across party lines. Some of them are within the Conservative Party. They're a little bit fluid. The language is very, very strong and quite sort of bitter. And it's very hard to know how you come up with anything that achieves a majority in this sort of very fractious sort of ferment that Westminster feels like at the moment.
Okay, let's get on to some of those tribes. I've got this image of Theresa May in Downing Street, sitting there with her jigsaw in front of her. You know, we know the obvious things. We know who the Tory loyalists are who will vote with her. We know the SNP, Lib Dems, other small parties will oppose her. Beyond that, talk us through the key groups.
Sitting in Parliament and watching it all unfold, Brexit has absolutely cut across party boundaries and the usual loyalties. And I'd say looking at it, she's facing at least five different groups. So there's the hard Brexiters. There's the sort of Remainers / soft Brexiters, really. There's Labour MPs in sort of Brexit-type seats. There's the DUP and there's the Labour leadership, of course.
Let's start with the true believers, the Brexiteers. Tell me about them.
Right, so these have been the most vocal group probably in the last 6 months or so. They're led by these very colourful figureheads, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson. They're rather sort of nostalgic about a Britain that was a sort of buccaneering country that ruled the waves and, you know, struck glorious free trade deals around the world.
The Prime Minister is absolutely clear that the sovereign legal structures of both the EU and the United Kingdom must be respected in any deal.
And they like to use rather arcane language. They like to talk about sovereignty and freedom and liberty, you know, the kinds of things that were summed up in that very resonant campaign slogan during the referendum campaign, Take Back Control.
Now this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance for us to take back control of this country. Can you hear me at the back?
Yay!
Because the organisation that we belong to now, the European Union, has changed out of all recognition.
And really, this group are not hung up on the details of the Irish backstop that we talked about earlier. What bothers them is the future trading relationship that we may have. And they believe that Theresa May is trying to link us much too closely to the EU in future. They want us to be able to write our own laws, our own regulations, our own rules. And they feel that the deal she's proposing, the so-called Chequers compromise, bashed out at her country residence in the summer, ties us much too closely in the long term to Brussels.
OK, so that's the hard Brexiteers, and most famous of them, of course, is Boris Johnson. And then out of nowhere, his brother Joe resigned, and he's actually part of your second group.
In fact, so great is the gulf now between what was promised in the referendum campaign and what is now on offer in the Prime Minister's proposed deal that I have had no choice but to submit my resignation to the Prime Minister this afternoon.
So Joe Johnson's surprise resignation on Friday was a reminder that this other group who really would quite like to stop Brexit, would quite like another referendum, but failing that, want the softest Brexit possible, are also quite powerful, also fairly numerous, maybe not quite as numerous as the hard Brexiters. And it feels a bit as though they have the wind in their sails. in this group, I suppose, are conservatives. There's Dominic Grieve, who's like the world's least likely rebel leader, incredibly well-spoken, polite lawyer, uses these sort of old-fashioned phrases, but devastating with it.
For them to go away, have several cups of tea, think again, continue talking to me about all those other sensible things we've been talking about and where we're likely to reach agreement.
Full outspoken, foul-mouthed ex-business minister, Anna Soubry.
And one has to wonder now, who is in charge? Who's running Britain?
This has been the making of her, really, this battle. And you know, she's taken everyone to task along the way.
I know where my money's sitting at the moment.
So Theresa May's got loads of trouble in her own party, which might explain why she's looking across the aisle in the House of Commons to your third group, Labour MPs who may have voted Remain but who represent Brexit constituencies.
These are Labour MPs who represent what you'd call sort of traditional Labour seats, many of them in the north of England. Many of them were sort of industrial areas, perhaps haven't done so well in the last 20, 30 years.
And my constituents who have been insulted day in and day out.
So one striking moment from this group came back in the summer when Caroline Flint, who represents a working class Labour community, gave a very powerful speech talking about the fact that her voters didn't want her to seek the softest possible relationship with the EU because they wanted her to do something about immigration and they didn't want her to stop Brexit or to make any moves in that direction. And she was then challenged quite strongly by the Conservative Anna Soubry.
Somebody who I have admired for many years, but have found that to be one of the saddest speeches that I've ever heard.
Do you have any idea how many Labour MPs there are in this group?
Maybe something like 10 that might be willing to vote with the government.
And then the fourth group, the Democratic Unionist Party. Do their 10 MPs hold the balance of power?
They're one of the groups that hold the balance of power. So the 2017 general election, if you cast your mind back, Theresa May said to the general public, please give me a massive mandate to negotiate Brexit. Public said, no, thank you very much, left her without a majority at all. And rather than at that stage say, I think this means I need to go for a softer Brexit, she decided to do a deal with the DUP, which is kind of unionist party in Northern Ireland, quite hard line, quite traditional, and very, very, very against anything that smacks of a sort of different regime in Northern Ireland.
What are they like as a group?
Very sort of patriotic, very British, they would say, and angry quite a lot of the time, I would say, from their interventions in the Commons.
But we have the right to speak for the people of Northern Ireland, and in this Parliament we will.
And there is another one that you mentioned, Labour's front bench. I mean, they could, in theory, save Theresa May.
In theory, they could. Labour has this sort of complex position, which is they have six tests they're going to hold Theresa May to, almost impossible tests to meet, I have to say. So at the moment, we're fully expecting them to vote against the deal, although Jeremy Corbyn did hold out a little sort of olive branch.
But let me also reach out to the Prime Minister. You see, I reach out to everybody.
Said to Theresa May, look, if you move closer to a customs union, if you assure us that you'll uphold workers' rights and environmental standards and other things, we might even throw our weight behind your deal.
But if you can't negotiate that deal, then you need to make way for a party that can and will.
What you're basically saying is that even if Theresa May gets her deal with Brussels, and that looks a bit sticky at the moment, she's got an almost impossible task in Parliament. I mean, the groups that you've set out, they all seem to have completely contradictory red lines. What happens if she doesn't get it through?
Well, the short answer is that nobody knows. We would be in uncharted territory. But there are a number of options. Labour says it would try and force a general election. It would do that by tabling a motion of no confidence in the government, although Theresa May could well win that, even if she hasn't got support for her deal. There are plenty of MPs who would try and bring about a second referendum. They would try and force the government to go back to the public before any deal takes place. Theresa May says if Parliament doesn't back her deal, the only alternative is a no deal. So we crash out without any free trade agreement or anything in place. MPs, and in particular the Labour leadership, say they won't let that happen. They'll try and, you know, put down motions in Parliament or amend bits of legislation to make that impossible for the government to do. Alternatively, the government could end up having to extend the deadline, which they would need approval from all the other EU member states for, if it's in a position where it can't get all of this done in time. Something else that could happen is that Theresa May could be challenged for the Conservative leadership. Her own party could decide it wants to put someone in charge of this process, although time would be short to do that before the Brexit deadline at the end of March.
You've done 60 seconds on a backstop. Give me 60 seconds on who could be the next Tory leader.
There's any number of candidates. Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, probably looks most likely. He's playing a very canny game. Boris Johnson isn't out of the race. David Davis quite fancies himself as a short-term caretaker leader to get Brexit over the line. And then there are sort of quieter candidates, Damian Hines, the Education Secretary, and various others, backbenchers even, Tom Tugendhat. It's incredibly difficult to say.
Sounds like a load of blokes, Heather.
There's a lot of them about.
Yeah. And just tell me, is there a way through this for her?
Well, look, it's still not impossible that she manages to strike that deal. She bullies and cajoles enough MPs over the line in Parliament to get it through. Or perhaps that it fails the first time and, you know, then she comes back with something slightly different and, you know, maybe the markets are crashing and MPs feel the stakes are higher and finally they give her their backing. But it's certainly not going to be easy.
Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Keep up with all our coverage on Brexit in Brussels and Westminster at theguardian.com. After the break, does Prince Charles really take a toilet seat with him on his travels? Welcome back. On the eve of Prince Charles's 70th birthday, Caroline Davies reflects on her 20 years reporting on the royals. She has literally climbed mountains to try to get the story.
So Charles is off in another mountain somewhere in another village. And we were going on ahead to wait for him in this small organic village way up in the Himalayas, right above the Indus. So he, of course, was coming in by helicopter. And we, of course, the press, were having to walk along this really rocky cliff path, not for the faint-hearted. And finally, we got to this small village where they were all really excitedly waiting Charles. Basically, the prince was late because he was held up in the previous village. Then they were presenting him with a yak. So we actually said to his aides, look, sorry, we're going to have to leave because we really don't want to walk back along that path in the dark. And suddenly, a helicopter was magicked up out of somewhere so that we could all remain there at this village for his arrival. It's really, really weird covering the royals because it's not like any other form of journalism that I do. Normally, as a journalist, you go straight to the subject directly, or you're covering an event because it's something extraordinary that's happened and it demands telling. But with the royals, you don't really get much direct access. And usually the event is the very fact that they're turning up. Nearly all the events that we cover with Prince Charles and the other royals are pretty much stage managed. He has a large press team. He has something like 10 press secretaries and assistant press secretaries. And one of the jobs is to control press access, of course. And I understand that because you can't have the press getting in the way of the engagement. But it does often mean that you are kept away at quite some distance from the event that you're covering. And I found, actually, that one of the most valuable tools that you can have as a royal reporter is a pair of binoculars, because sometimes you're placed so far away, you really can't see what's happening at all. I think because people are so fascinated by the royals and by Charles, I think when there is a gap in information, it really does open it up for people to say whatever they like. And there's been lots of weird and wonderful allegations over the years, some of which have stuck. One of them is that he takes a toilet seat with him wherever he goes. I think where that stemmed from probably was, I think Princess Anne gave him a toilet seat for a Christmas present a long time ago. The Windsors, they do this at Christmas. They've got this sort of thing where they give each other really frivolous gifts. And probably Charles probably said, oh, yeah, I'll take it with me absolutely everywhere. But I think there's scant evidence for that one. We don't really know the real Charles. Occasionally, we get glimpses, but not as much as we would all like, because we're all fascinated. He is going to be our future king. On the eve of his 70th birthday, as he's setting out his stall as what kind of king he's going to be, one of the criticisms that he's had to address really is whether or not he is going to be a meddling king. Over the years, there's no doubt that he has been seen as an interventionist prince. The Guardian spent 10 years in legal battle trying to get some of his so-called black spider memos to government ministers released to the public. So that does show that he has been happy to meddle, although he sees it as motivating and convening power. Recently, he was asked about this in a BBC documentary, and he made it very clear that he's not that stupid, that he says he can differentiate between the relatively unfettered role of Prince of Wales and the very constitutionally fettered role of King. He stresses that he will respect the constitutional parameters, and I'm sure that he will seek to do that. But I suppose the irony is we probably never know.
That's all we've got time for today. If you are enjoying Today in Focus, please, please subscribe and review us, ideally nicely. My thanks to Caroline Davies and Heather Stewart. Today's producers were Josh Kelly, Rachel Humphreys, Brenna Daldorf and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design is by Axel Cocoutier and the executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Join us again tomorrow.